Dewey's here at Groundswell this year, the 26th and 27th of June, close to London, UK. Many friends of the podcast will be there. John Kempf, Abby Rose, Benedict Boezel, Henry Dimbleby, Claire Hill, Russ Carrington, Andy Cato, Tim Coates, and many, many more. See you there. Checking in with Gijs of Grounded on how their fair and transparent wholesale regenerative ingredient business is doing and why Gijs is more optimistic about the possibilities of building successful and profitable businesses based on regenerative agriculture practices and why the focus on quality, taste and transparency of smaller food brands is creating the demand to make a significant change on the ground. Not all roses and sunshine. We obviously also get into why, even with all this experience and significant track record, it is difficult to raise capital for regen agroecology businesses in the Global South. This is the Investing in Regenerative Agriculture and Food podcast, Investing as if the planet mattered, where we talk to the pioneers in the regenerative food and agriculture space to learn more on how to put our money to work to regenerate soil, people, local communities, and ecosystems while making an appropriate and fair return. Why my focus on soil and regeneration? Because so many of the pressing issues we face today have their roots in how we treat our land and our sea, grow our food, what we eat, wear, and consume. And it's time that we as investors, big and small, and consumers start paying much more attention to the dirt/soil underneath our feet. To make it easy for fans to support our work, we launched our membership community, and so many of you have joined us as a member. Thank you. If our work created value for you, and if you have the means, and only if you have the means, consider joining us. Find out more on gumroad.com/investing-in-regen-ag. That is gumroad.com/investing-in-regen-ag. Or find the link below. Welcome to another episode. Today we have Gijs Boers. Welcome back on the podcast to talk about Grounded and everything that happened since March last year, March 2021, when we last talked. And in the life of a startup and a scale-up, a lot of things are happening in such a short period, or such a long period, actually. So I'm very happy to have Gijs back. Welcome, Gijs.
Thanks, Koen, and great to be back again.
So obviously I will put the previous interviews, I think we called it The Good, The Bad and The Ugly of Regen Ag, in the links below, and also an interview we did, I think 3, 4, maybe 5 years ago even. But just to for everybody to refresh our memories, what is Grounded and what is Grounded now? Let's say we're talking the end of April in 2022. How would you describe Grounded for somebody that has never heard about it?
I think the common line over the past a small decade has been, we want to scale regenerative agriculture in Africa and increase the income of farmers. We started off with doing some business development around landscape restoration. I think for most of you aware that agriculture is the biggest threat to healthy landscapes. We entered into regenerative agriculture and tried to get a transition towards regen agri up in Africa. And we found the big hurdles and challenges. So eventually we ended up with setting up a processing company that together with a group of farmers to buy produce from farmers, process it and sell it. And through that company, offer a lot of support to the farmers in their transition. That is still the common thread of Grounded. Still, we're taking active positions in the value chain. But how we do that in more detail, that has changed a lot over time. I think through many hurdles, mistakes, and hard work and perseverance, we manage step by step to make the model more perfect. And I think, like a regenerative system, it's a step by step. But the nice thing is, as you do, once you're on the road and you start picking up pace, slowly but surely you're getting there.
And as you're so deep into the space, and what has something changed fundamentally? You see in the sector, or the conversations you had over the last year. Like the last 12 months, I mean, I see definitely an uptick on the podcast, definitely an uptick in my email box of people wanting information, connections, introductions. And if you want to, please, all listeners, reach out. I cannot promise I answer in a few days, because the flow is getting quite strong. But I see a change in the last 18 months, in the last year as well. Like there's there seems to be more happening, or at least our bubble is growing. Do you feel the same, or how is that in, let's say, the regen movement in Africa, in Southern Africa, or the agroecology movement? Obviously, there's a bigger umbrella there. What do you feel there on the ground? Has something been changing there as well, or is it the same old, it's still very much neglected, or at least from let's say, abroad?
Yeah, there's always multiple answers to such a question, but it's definitely the case that when we started, regen, if you would Google regenerative agriculture, there were a couple thousand hits. When we started at Groundnut and we first started to look into regenerative agriculture, you know, we constantly had to explain what regenerative agriculture was and every conversation you started. And after a couple of years, you would run into more people say, yeah, we know regenerative agriculture, or we do agroforestry, or we've been in touch with it. And now I almost never explain anymore in most of the conversation what regen agri is. And from time to time, you get these people to say, regenerative agriculture, is that like sustainable agriculture? And then you say, okay. And I think that explains how well you're doing your job, Koen, with spreading the word, because we are a B2B in the background. And although we've picked up communication a lot over the past 2 years, but I think a big kudos to you for spreading the word and making it more familiar and bringing people more up to speed on the potential.
The potential and the challenges, yeah.
And you do the potential, and then we explain.
We do the challenges. You do the challenges,
yeah. And to make sure that people, our communication focuses on the challenges and the hurdles that we've overcome, and to make sure that people don't lose faith in that transition, because I think that's one of the key things in our communication normally, that it's not easy to get there. But there are ways to get it. There are quick wins, and it's just sometimes sad to see some people giving up.
Tell yourself, or what do you tell them to not give up? Like people, like in any transition, it's often the darkest just before the light, or it can be really tough, especially the first years. Of course, depending on the soil, the landscape, the company. But it is definitely a very rough journey in many, many cases. I've yet to hear a story where somebody said, oh, it was so easy just to switch from a heavily input dependent form of agriculture to something that's much more knowledge intensive, much more interesting, but much more complex as well. Like what do you, like internally, how do you, because you're running different companies, you're part of different, like there are different levels, let's say, or different parts of their journey or different pieces. How do you make sure you keep going? Is it because you've seen some success and say, okay, we know at some point we'll figure out a recipe that works, let's just keep going, keep trying? Or how do you keep morale up when you're in those dark moments where stuff dies and things don't grow, or things grow too fast, which means you have weeds everywhere?
To give a practical example, I think in Zambia, a couple of years, we run a training scheme with hundreds and eventually small up in thousands of farmers. And I think if you look over the entire program, the total results were not significant enough. But if we looked at the top 10% performers in that program, and you see the results and you see the quick wins that can be gained. And by looking at, okay, what makes these farmers successful? What other hurdles do other farmers have? And you try to hold on not to the total success or the bottom line success as a company in those early years, but I think you look a lot at the quick wins and to see what works and where it works. And have a strong belief. We all know that we have to find different ways. And you focus on the wins, and you have an amazing team, and we have so many people in the team that all feel, okay, we have to do it differently. It's not going to be easy, but we just keep going. And then you motivate each other. And based on the first results that you see with some of the farmers that do pick it up and that do make it into a success, yeah, that was just enough spark to keep us going. But I think sometimes looking back, I think our biggest um, Our biggest strength was our perseverance.
Stubbornness. And just in Zambia, just to reiterate, what is the current status of that project and that company? What did you, after a number of years of, let's say, trial and error and R&D, what have you found there that is working?
Do you want to learn how to invest, or are you an entrepreneur and want to build companies in the regenerative food and agriculture space? Or do you work in big ag and big food and want to really move the needle? We have developed a new video course for you. Find out more on investinginregenerativeagriculture.com/course or in the show notes description below.
The details, Zambia is also a larger country with quite some significant differences in climate zone. But the area we operated in, the southern part, closer to Namibia, was a lot drier. We've seen that for a lot of farmers, they grew a bit of crops, more of an insurance on the side, but weren't really seeing farming as a business, or really doing farming more commercially. And some of the younger generations that would stay in that area, they try to do it. And what we've done is we've been now trying to invest more heavily in those top performers and also aggregate them a bit. So we try to, we've picked a location with a lot of good farmers in the neighborhood and try to centralize a bit of irrigation, compost making. So these family farmers still have their own family farm, but one of the family members or some of the family members come to more of our centralized farming location there, where there's more affordable irrigation because it's more economies of scale, but where we super intense regen farming model, I would say, with agroforestry lanes, high diversity, focused on high value crops, and I mean vegetables, crops that require a lot of labor. But we combine that with a very strong management team, a large amount of knowledge, research, data gathering. And then there's also, for example, there's a tractor that these families share. So the best farmers now not only use the half of their time to making beds and rows, that work is being done, but they focus on managing their crops, the disease, monitoring, making high quality.
And then the idea is for them to bring that back to their family farm to spread it, or to expand this, let's say, high intensive optimized farm combination.
Yeah, it's a combination of both. So you want to, we want to scale both. I think that's a relatively well-developed model in Zambia to have, let's say, an anchor or base, and from there work with farmers in the neighborhood. And there, actually production has commenced, and it's actually going really well. So that's the crops look good, the soils respond very well, and the farmers respond very well. So that's a good start. And another, we've chosen location because a new connection to Botswana was opening up. There's a new border post opened, a new bridge. We're tracking prices of the informal market. Yeah, I'm fascinated by these informal markets. The inefficiencies, but also the efficiencies, the trust. That's for a different podcast, but we're tracking prices throughout Zambia, and we now at a location where prices are higher since that opening of the bridge and since that connection opening up again. So it's, after all those years and going from challenge to challenge, you're now in a position where, and we see that over across ground, that we're getting more and more into petitions where things are actually going better than expected, and there's a lot of momentum. So that's amazing.
That's been a while, yeah. And then now, what's your position now? What's your relationship with that company in Zambia? Are you still very, very much involved? Or you mentioned management team, or are you also, I would say, on your way out because it is going? Or what's your connection still with
the Grounded? This is maybe to talk about the relation between Grounded and these companies in our portfolio. We refer to them as operating companies. In the beginning, we were very much involved. We were small teams, and also on the ground, we didn't have a lot of resources. That has changed. It was a big step for Grounded. In Zambia, we're building much stronger teams on the ground, much more staking on. Whereas we as Grounded take more of a, we support finance for these opcos. We work a bit on strategy. If they export, we obviously support on that. We support on the legal side, but much more of the operations happens on the ground, much more of the decisions, what they produce, how they produce it. It's supported by our region agri team. And one of the biggest transitions we have made is that we're using our experience of building these companies from scratch. And we're now working more and more with existing entrepreneurs that are in an early stage. And I think that's one of the biggest transitions that we've made over the past. We said to ourselves, okay, how can we scale and how can we optimize the lessons and our failures that we have made in the past. And when looking for new opportunities, we came in touch with other entrepreneurs, and there was an amazing click, mainly because we shared a lot of we have a lot of shared mistakes and a lot of shared challenges. And
so you find each other in the suffering, then, or in the obstacles you ever, or in, let's frame it differently, in the recipe seeking of what works in this context. And of course you have a million stories about that, and they have those as well. So do you have an example of, like, in these journeys you now actually are sort of switching from setting these operating companies up from scratch by Grounded to partnering with already existing, in many cases small, but still existing company. There is already something there. There is an entrepreneur, there's a team, there's stuff being produced, being sold, being lost in some cases. And you partner with them to say, okay, how do we bring this to the next regenerative level or the next business level as well? Like, how does that process work? You meet them at a fair, you meet them at trips. How do you find these diamonds in the rough, I think is the term. How do you find them when they're not so shiny yet?
Via several channels. I think if you work in the African continent for 10 years, you obviously have a network, but also on trade first, literally. You see companies supplying produce from Africa. People reach out to us on how to, you know, do we want to be far more regenerative, where do we start? But to give an example, and it maybe also links to your question that you started, do you see a change in the acceptance of region agri, or the more adaptant of the world to that? And so we had a company, the first company that we partnered up with an existing entrepreneurial team, was a Dutch spies entrepreneur and a Tanzanian spies entrepreneur. They started working together. He was a spice farmer, and the Dutch spice trader invested in him, slowly buying some produce and getting it into Europe. When one of our marketing team members was talking to him, he said, yeah, I see the problems in the world. He's actually of the generation that would normally not be so interested, but I think he's a unique person. And said, no, we need to work differently. I want to make an impact. And if I want to get, I see the problem in the spice industry, the problems of using pesticides is enormous. EU is toughening regulations. So there's huge problems in India. I think in India, a lot of organic organizations have lost their licenses because of some
fraudulent schemes.
Also pesticide residues. And he said, yeah, we need alternatives. And if I want to, I want to be sure that I get sustainable spices out of Tanzania, I need this part to be covered. And that's how we started talking, looking into the company. They needed to raise finance. And eventually we said, yeah, we've raised finance for companies that only existed on paper. You have an amazing business. That company was set up in a Tanzanian way, I think very pragmatic. You just start and see. And there was a lot of interest from buyers. They were scared about their current sourcing areas. It spices a lot of one sourcing, main sourcing area for one crop. And they say, no, we want to diversify. We see the risks. So that business picked up. But when we came in and we tried to partner up, and we said, okay, we are not consultants, so we want to be part of this company. And so we tried to figure out how can we become part of the company. In the end, we raised capital to invest in this business. And that's also how our investment company was born. I will talk about that a bit later.
It's a nice bridge, but let's unpack the spices a bit further.
But we saw this business, and I think it took us a significant amount of time and effort and resources to build a strong foundation for the business, to almost redo the business from scratch in some of the business fundamentals. So finance, legal, bookkeeping. One of our colleagues moved out there to live next to the factory and to live together with the entrepreneur to support him on some of the aspects that he wasn't really, he didn't really come across in the past, so to speak. So he was really good with sourcing the produce. He was a spice farmer himself, so he knew quality, he knew how to get it, how to pack it, and together with the Dutch spice trade, how to process it and get it EU ready. But that took so much of his time that I think all the admin was just laying there, and we've already done that, asked for new permits, we supported them on getting the organic certification with some support of the Dutch government throughout that process. So that was super helpful. And in the end, we managed to get everything in order, raise some investments into this company, become a co-owner of the business, where indeed we again support a bit on strategy. Our region agri team is supporting their own region agri team so that they set up in-house. And ideas.
And so what in the spices are the biggest challenges? Like where are they now, this company, or where they're sourcing from? And where could that go to in terms of growing practices? Is that super complex agroforestry systems? Is it what do you see there to make that transition that the entrepreneur wanted to get rid of a lot of the inputs and a lot of the risks and a lot of the fragility in the system? What do you see? Where could a spices system go to? Like, I don't know. Describe it for us. Let's say visually, because we're obviously in audio. Like, what should we imagine when you say a spice farmer?
Well, it's different around the world. But in Tanzania, what you see and where the challenges are, where the opportunity are, is first we choose spices because it's actually in many instances a great agroforestry crop. But that's also where the challenge is, because what you see is that natural forest would first be partly cleared for some under canopy growth of pepper or cardamom. And if you don't replenish that system, you will see it deteriorates over time. It's been replaced by other crops that are less high value, more of the canopy is cut, and eventually you're left with cassava fields. And after the cassava, after a couple of years of cassava, your soil is drained. Now, the advantage of these more tropical climates is that the region agri is generally a bit easier. The more water, the faster it grows, the shorter the cycles, you have more growing seasons. So obviously the benefit as well is that if we create a market for pepper and now for organic pepper, and try to work with the farmers to establish new plantations eventually in areas that are were previous spice areas, if we can bring them back into production, you can automatically create some form of an agroforestry system. Now, for us, obviously, this is a long trajectory, and it starts with trying to maintain the current plantations, so get up production. Another example,
so not have
is
it slowly go down to cassava, basically.
Yeah, there's a wilting problem. So Tanzanian government organizations are providing organic sprays for that. So that's super helpful. But the big problem is a lack of compost, proper composting, proper moisture management on these plants. So I think our region agri team is working hard to find some small, make some practical interventions, how you can prevent that that problem from starting in the first place. And so I think these transitions and what we've learned in the past, these are very long timelines, and it starts with some of the quick wins, getting momentum with the first group of farmers, and then getting the same thing to a new group of farmers, but with your first group slowly advancing. And it would be great if one day we can get their cassava fields back into thriving agroforestry production areas, because they would make much more money on that if we do it properly. And if they don't have to sell out their pepper, you know, 1 month before harvesting, because now sometimes they're selling at 30% of the value just 1 month before harvesting, because they don't have forced the cash flow to get through that last month. And so there's a lot of
classic trader farmer issue. Yeah,
exactly.
Season issue.
So those are the gains, and it's a long trajectory, but we're taking it step by step, farmer by farmer. I think the company sources for about 2,000 farmers, and I think what they do amazingly, and what we would have done wrong probably in if we would have done it from scratch, is they really work well within the current system, within the middlemen, within the traders, taking it step by step. We would have thought, no, this needs to be radically different, which is super impressive, and that's where I think the local entrepreneur and his skills really come into play and say, no, you know, you don't want these guys. You need these middlemen. They know quality. They know where the farmers are. They know the good farmers, the reliable farmers. And if we can incentivize them a bit and get a relationship to pay a bit more at a certain time and compensate him for that. And so they're working really well within that system step by step. And I think that's super impressive, and also really realistic of what they can do today and what they can do tomorrow. But having this strong dot on the horizon, you know, this is where we're going to, and we're doing it step by step.
Yeah, no, I will put in the show notes, we did a very interesting interview, or at least I thought, on syntropic agroforestry, or how complex agroforestry can be, but also what the potential is of it, all the different layers. And also, I think good friend of the show, Massimiliano, sent a video on, I think it was disease on coffee, and how that was caused by basically having the coffee plant in the wrong spot in the height, basically, of the system, while it was catching too much moisture and was getting sick because of that. So there's so many of these little things that, if a system is done properly, and properly is a really weird word here, but there are many things you can avoid, but you have to really understand well, like, where does the pepper want to be, and where does it thrive compared to the other plants in the system, and how do you make sure, first of all, to keep it obviously in a way that it doesn't deteriorate towards cassava, and then how do you make a system where the pepper actually thrives? And those are questions we've asked ourselves. I mean, we've asked ourselves recently, and probably a long time ago, but in the last 20 years, maybe not so much in these systems. Like, what is a thriving pepper system? I don't know if many people can answer that, unfortunately, but it's a research that we need to do, because we need to know how to, and then how do we bring it back at speed? To grow these systems and not have to wait 20, 30 years. That's fascinating. Our R&D in an already, let's say, functioning system that is going, and there's being peppers being exported. It's not that you have to start from scratch like you used to do. So that's a big shift. And this is a natural bridge towards GIC, let's say, towards like doing this partnering with and investing in existing companies more often. When did this realization came? Was it with this example on the pepper side? Like, it's like, wow, there are actually entrepreneurs where we can add a lot of value. We can skip some steps and probably actually avoid some mistakes we would have otherwise made if we would have gone into pepper, organic peppers, etc. Like, when does that realization came, and where is that now? What is GIC, and where is it gonna go if it's up to you?
Yeah, so GIC stands for the Ground and Investment Company. And it came indeed from raising capital for this business. There's always been a bit of a push from investors to invest at a broader grounded level. But since we've always set up companies from scratch and with close partnership with other NGOs, existing partners, we've always raised that capital on an individual level.
Which makes running grounded difficult, I think. Like the holding company or the company above it, and you mentioned your legal team, your regen team, your sourcing team. Of course, now grounding ingredients, we'll talk about it later, is separate now. But there's a lot of support you give that is coming from a centralized team that has to be paid for. So if all the money flows to the different operating companies, it's going to be tricky for you guys, or that was tricky.
Yeah, no, 100%. But it's that, but it's also so it's from investors. They want to be part of the but it's also these companies now, they are further down the line. So they have passed a certain stage. They have some revenue. So it makes it interesting again for a new group of investors. And it makes it also more eligible for an investment company. I think secondly for us, if we want to work with these organizations, they need capital, and they don't need all the capital up front, but to start up and they're going into a new direction and expand the business. If you have some money ready and you don't have to, because with this spice company Trianon, the challenge was that we didn't have the money up front, and I think it would have saved us about half of the time, so about 8 or 9 months in whole of the trajectory. If we would have had the money, or at least part of the money, to make an initial investment and close a deal and get on. The GIC is the combination of investing, but also with an active support arm. And that's what I've said in the past. A lot of investors wouldn't step into a company. We see a company with a lot of potential and a great entrepreneur.
But a spice company in Tanzania is it's far away from many, literally.
Other investors see two guys that see a lot of risks. So they think, okay, they see books being, there's this difference.
Admin is not there, it's not done.
The admin is missing behind the books, or... organic certification is now pending for a while, or especially in Africa.
So this is it gives you the investor, gives the opportunity to step into a structure. Can we call it a fund? No, it's not a fund. Like a structure that then invests in these kind of the spice example, the pepper example we just mentioned, and then more like you invest in a portfolio of these kind of companies, and add, of course, a lot of support. I mean, it's not just we put in a few hundred thousand in spices and then good luck. No, I mean, what you mentioned now, it's the full thing on restructuring, on admin, on organic certification, on Regen Ag team on the ground, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But do you call it a fund? Like how do you call it as a structure?
Yeah, we call it an investment company because it's doing more than simply investing. It is also a bit of fund alike. So you can, if you call it a fund, but we always try to frame it as a company because it's a traditional company or traditional fund, have these people thinking about X% management fees and this, but there's a lot of funds, traditional funds active in Africa, and I think they're missing out on a lot of opportunities.
Because they're not investment ready yet.
Not investment ready. And you see a lot of Western EU entrepreneurs, and don't get me wrong, Tekla and I are part of it, that want to make an impact. And why can you make an impact in Africa? And they have a lot of things in order, when it comes to reporting, strong strategic plan, strong business plan, strong impact plan. How do you get there? But they and also struggle on getting operations up. In Africa, it's not the business plan that is the biggest challenge, or making a good business plan. The biggest challenge is a good execution, and you need a strong local team. So
I would argue that's almost everywhere the case. But that's it's very nice. Everything sounds nice on PowerPoint, but. Especially in agriculture, like the context locally, nice in PowerPoint to do certain things in Australia, but good luck doing it if you're not deeply embedded there, or in Italy, or in the Netherlands, as we know well, or in Ecuador. I mean, this is not running a SaaS platform somewhere that you can almost run, I wouldn't say from everywhere, but if your internet connection is okay, you sort of can. This is, you have to dance the local dance, otherwise... it's just going to go flat on your face. And we've seen many people going flat on their face. I think you've seen many as well. So you say they're missing out because it's not in that perfect clean order. The PowerPoint doesn't make complete sense yet, or is not there. But the business is there and the opportunity is there.
Yeah. And maybe I'm also now a bit harsh, but it's also our experience. And, you know, we're very selective in the companies we work with because they have to fit exactly in the type of experience that we as a team have. And we are also able to do it and able to see through and focus on these companies because we have set up very similar companies. We can't do this in a different sector, or we can't do it for in the energy sector. There's probably maybe some entrepreneurs there as well, but we wouldn't be able to do it because we won't have that. We don't have that specific experience. So it's also the experience that allows us to make some blend between being an investment company and a business developer.
And when it's so specific, are you worried that you're not going to find many? Like how likely, how many companies are you going to have in this company? What's your, is it 5, 10, 50? And how easy is it to find the perfect one? Not perfect doesn't exist, but like this spice example in like the pepper one, like how big is your pipeline yet and how many do you need?
Yeah, I have to say, I was frightened sometimes to say, is this just a perfect example and are there many more? But the goal is to do about one a year, two a year. Now, especially in the early days, about one a year. And it's two ways that we have to make sure we also get a success out of the businesses that are part of the investment company. But I think we can close a second deal before the end of the year. I'm not going too deep into that, into the tea business. And I'm actually surprised. We set up our business development team or pipeline team set up a temporary office in East Africa. So they switch a bit around Africa, set up temporarily offices and operate from that location for 6 to 8 weeks. So that's also maybe answering a bit of your question, how we find them. I was a bit relieved to see so many of these companies in our sweet spot. And I'm now very confident that we can do more than one a year if we raise the capital. But in the end, it's not about the total volume. I think we take it step by step, company by company, but I think if we would bring it up to 5, 6 over the coming four years about, then I think we're doing very well. It's also companies with significant opportunities for scaling. So that can absorb, you know, maybe initially need between $300,000 to $500,000 investment, but eventually can absorb $3 to $5 million investment within the next 5 to 10 years. So because there's a huge amount of supply available on in either of these companies we're looking into. The market for teas, spices, coffee, cacao, but also mixed farm operations are some of the operations we now look into. And these markets are so big. So there's for now, there's enough opportunity. And it's finding the right entrepreneur, I think, is more important. So far, so very, very proud of the achievements of that, of our pipeline team. I think it's super impressive. Also, how not only finding them, but also working together with them to jointly make a business plan to present to our investment board into the investment company. So that's amazing.
And you mentioned the investor side. How is that going? How are investors responding to a fund not being a fund? And you said this was partly because investors have difficulty investing directly into these companies unless they're really on the ground, unless they understand everything, and then they probably potentially don't need you. Like how is that been raising capital for? And not for one company that you've always done until now, but for a different suite of companies and a number of unknown companies yet. Like you can raise, of course, for the pepper one, for Ground Ingredients and Honeybush, but not for a few others yet. They're not known yet. Yeah, maybe tea. But so how has that journey been, or how has that switch been for you to start raising this capital?
There's been a huge range of different viewpoints, reactions, obviously. But one of one of the luxuries we have is that we have a couple of partners that really walk the journey alongside. I think you once gave us a couple of years or 5 years ago the advice to bring some investors into your theater, keep them up, take them along the journey. And so now part of the outcome of that journey is they said, no, don't raise too much capital up front. Go with an anchor investment, raise an investment, do your first investment, and raise a bit more investment when you have another opportunity. So we do more case by case, with each round raising a bit more than we need. So slowly but surely, working with larger rounds, so we don't spend so much time.
So that means you raise the one for the spices, and now yes. You're going to start talking about the tea potentially, but you have a bit of time to do that. But of course, you want to have the money sort of almost ready when you go, because otherwise you have the same problem as before where you had to wait for the money to come and the company wanted to move. So it's chicken and egg.
Yeah, that's what we call the product market loop, or it's always what comes first. And you have to build them simultaneously. And that's what we're doing. And I think it's been, we're just a bit lucky that, the winds are full in the sails on the first opportunity and on the pipeline. So, yeah, sometimes you need to be a bit lucky. And since those things are going really well, it's easier. It gets more traction. It becomes more tangible. But we see we have a couple of investors that for which we're still too small. So, there's huge amounts of money from each source is committed to Africa, but that allows for larger ticket size. We are still very conservative in what we promise. We don't want to overpromise. So we initially set about 4-7% net return, meaning that 2 out of 5 companies need to be successful. But given now seeing how it goes, the type of pipeline and where these companies stand, I think it's more realistic to assume that 3 or 4 out of 5 companies are going to succeed. Or not that 3 out of 5 companies would have to liquidate after a second or a third round of investment. So we've been very conservative, too conservative, I think, in our first instances. Also driven by our own experiences and knowledge, and we know how difficult the journey is.
Yeah.
No, so I think we've always had a bit of a motto, try to, under promise, over deliver. And I think we've now, that's maybe scared of, maybe we've been too conservative, so we're a bit more optimistic there. But still, then promising about a 10% net return to investors for going into in Africa, that's still not super high. Although there is potential that it can be much higher, but we all know what happens. It can be a regime change, or everything can happen. We've seen it all. Severe droughts. Look at the north of Kenya. Yeah, if that happens in one of our areas, then there's not a lot we can do. But basically what it comes down to is that a lot of the huge amounts of money are basically become unavailable because they're distributed from funds to funds to funds. So even if they're impact and let's say through 3% or 4% return target on the top, when it's filtered down to the smaller investment funds with management layer after management layer, they already need 15 to 20% return. So we really target family offices, people that want to, combine financial return with impact return. We are not there yet that we can provide the same financial return as the traditional private equity and deliver on the impact. We don't see that realistically happen in the short term. So that means you get a lot of impact through these businesses. But it also
but a different risk profile as well. I mean, there's a different risk profile there. I think people really you're selling real stuff. It's there will be demand for coffee, tea, spices, etc. If you're in a private equity fund, the risk is that nothing comes back. The risk profile of certain payment app software things, etc. is very, very, very different. So I don't think it's very fair. Plus, in agriculture, people have to understand we're operating in very degraded landscapes where we extracted a lot of value over the last let's say hundreds or in many cases thousands of years. So there is a, I wouldn't say a debt to pay, but there is a debt to pay there. There is money that needs to be resources, compost, organic matter, whatever you want to call it, that needs to flow back into that we cannot extract immediately, or maybe we cannot extract ever. So there is something there on returns that, you know, if somebody promised you 25% on regen ag, I would ask a lot of questions. And because there is a debt to pay, we have to replenish the soils we have extracted so much, and the communities we've extracted so much value and capital from. So let's not kid ourselves. And a return is possible, but it's not going to be 20 plus, 30 plus, or whatever the amount is. Unless you maybe earn some technology companies. I mean, there I see some possibilities for a short amount of time. We had an interesting interview with Mark Lewis of Trailhead Capital, hunting for unicorns. But then you're investing in a very, very narrow, I'll put the link below, in a very, very narrow part of the regen ag movement. If you're an ag, yeah, it's going to be different. I mean, I think a full grown old forest has a growth rate of 3% or something. So that might be the optimum at some point when ecosystems are mature. That's what we can harvest. And that's it. But let's not kid ourselves with crazy returns. But I imagine it's very, very difficult for you having to explain that to invest and say, yeah, but I can go somewhere else and get this, of course, on paper, I get at XYZ, et cetera, et cetera. So it's a difficult dance.
Yeah, 100%. But that's also why you and your podcast is so important, Koen, to spread this message over and over, and that it's not only coming from us, but from a lot of different persons. So that's helping us tremendously. So please keep spreading that word. And we are trying to show that risks are lower, because in the end, value is total return or profits and risks. And with our approach, we try to de-risk investors. We do have investors that say, yeah, I was hesitant to make the step to Africa. You know, it's still this idea that, you know, that people in Africa, it's difficult sometimes. Can you trust people in Africa? If I'm sometimes at a party and say, can you trust them? And then I tell them, well, the biggest challenge that we ever had was a European company that didn't promise on buying the produce at the price they promised. And in later on, it turned out a huge fraud scandal in that company. And so I said our biggest, we have ever been, yeah, what's a decent word? Screwed over.
Scammed.
I'm not sure if that's decent. Sorry, apologies. But
scammed.
Scammed was with a European company. If you have the right procedures in place, and
that's of course the issue, that a lot of the money is far away outside Africa. We keep talking about like it's one country beyond the continent, let's say, because it has been extracted in the past. It sits in very shiny offices very far away from the place where it has been extracted. And are you working with local family offices? Local, I mean, African family offices, South African, Zambia, Kenya. Like, is that something that is happening on the impact side, something that you, of course, would love to, because they are much closer to the reality and you don't have to explain these kind of things at parties? Like, is that something that starts to rise as well? Like, there are local money flowing into these kind of things?
More and more. A lot of the African wealth is still first generation. And I think if you look back to European family offices, you see significant differences through generations. Actually, today, there's an article in the newspaper about it and the challenge at infight into traditional and family offices between generations. But especially in South Africa, you see with new generations, you see that change. And actually, we've just raised our first investment capital from a South African family offices, one of actually the largest, I think, South African family offices. They invested in our honeybush company with a very flexible instrument because they see they want to change how we set up businesses, how we run businesses in Africa. And they say that this our honeybush company provides a great opportunity to build a new industry and to build it in a different way. We've talked about honeybush in the past in our previous podcast, so I won't go into detail too much. But you know, these are family offices that, yes, for generations have been working in Africa and have been successfully investing throughout the continent. They are 100% aware of the trade-offs about, and they see not only the risks, but also the opportunities. And I've once met a family office, not a Dutch family office. They were one of the first who went to China. And they now look to Africa and they see opportunities. But I think that's still a small amount, a smaller group. But what helps is that the younger generation really sees Africa also for its potential, but also for its impact potential. But just the differences between the groups are huge. And I think the vast majority still is probably run by people over, you know, that are more senior than you and I, let's say, more experienced than you
and I. That's not annoying too many people listening to this, yeah, but there is definitely in the family office business. Yeah, yeah.
Because our 60-year-old spice trader partner is a front runner.
Yeah, but
we have to do
usually
different.
With age, there is, I mean, with different generations and with age, there is logically, because you are older, there is a certain resistance against change, a certain resistance against, we always have done things like this, so we are always doing things like that. I think many farmers who are listening can attest to that if they're talking to their different generations, let's say their parents, and unless you had very, very forward-thinking or crazy parents, you even organic is already tricky, or messy fields are not the way we do it. Like, the season only ends in the Netherlands, that's a nice saying, when the plow is cleaned and stored away and all the fields are nicely dark and turned. And like, that's the same in family office, in managing money. Like, every shift in, oh, let's look beyond risk and return and also to impact is a very fundamental shift. And it's not going to be easy for most people to join that if you've done differently for 20, 30, 40 years. I mean, let's not kid ourselves. And if you're grown up in a different way and you've traveled the world and you've seen what other ways are there, of course, and you're 30, then it's very, very different. Not easy, because you might not have the control. But yeah, you can definitely be sort of the quote-unquote activist shareholder that with a very small percentage of the shares try to move the gigantic company or the family office or the gigantic farm. I think the models are all the same.
Yeah, and I think there's a big role for family offices that are front runners on this, to show other family offices how they are doing it, how they engage with the different generations, the different models, and how they slowly transition. And we try to get them to go out and visit our businesses. We say, just come out and see for yourself. I can't.
Yeah, I remember last time we talked, like, there's 100% success rate when people visit. Like, then it's, yeah, you cannot not invest after. Not that because you force them to, but because it's so interesting and you fall in love with the companies. So that's, yeah. But yeah, South Africa, Zambia, Tanzania is far, literally and figuratively. So, and especially in these crazy COVID years, it's been difficult to travel, but hopefully you're getting a few people, like, let's say they're on the fence, to come over, see it, and then they can sign and get some money flowing back into the continent and back into the soil.
Yeah, but I have to say, it's what you say, if people come, they often invest. But that's also the challenge, because the people that are actually thinking up front, hey, I'm going, this is a serious opportunity, they come and then, but I want people to come out that are really doubting, that I really think, I'm not sure. I don't think this, but getting those people to commit time out of their busy lives to visit, and hopefully I can join them with a nice safari or visiting the Vic Falls or whatever, try to get them out and to see for themselves. And I think that's for us one of the challenges, because it is so far away, to see the difference between the farmers. But also, it is challenging because I've also been on some of these trips and have seen only the good stuff. And I think I've also seen, yeah, family officers say, yeah, we've done trips of this and you only see the good things and you don't see the bad things. So yeah, this comes to the good, the bad and the ugly. But to everybody, bringing people out, show reality, because we now seriously have people say, yeah, we've done this in the past. We were super enthusiastic and we're super disappointed by the actual results. So it's also sometimes harming us as an industry.
Of course. And I want to be conscious of your time. We can talk for hours on the good, the bad, and ugly and much more. But just as a very brief recap, how is Grounded Ingredients, as we promised during this interview, how is that going? It launched after we talked last time. What has been happening with, what is, first of all, Grounded Ingredients, and what has been happening the last, let's say, 13 months?
Grounded Ingredients was for us a way to basically change a bit of the current middle segment in the value chain, the current wholesale companies. These companies especially, for example, in Germany, there's a tremendous amount of family companies that buy produce from all over the world, blend it, get it up to a minimum standard, and sell it. Now, if you are, they provide a great, low-cost, reliable, same-tasting, meeting minimum standards product. Now,
we're talking about tea, or what are we talking about?
We talk about tea, in general, talk about spices, like we talk about
coffee, spices, like the high-end coffee. Cash crops, yeah. Yeah,
yeah. Chocolate. And with coffee, the good thing about coffee, it's in your podcast is often referred to, and we refer to it in one of our previous podcasts, like the wineification of the industry. So you see coffee from a certain source, a certain farm, a certain.
And you're trying to supply the next wineification of the things after the coffee bean, bean to bar, the whole movement there. Yeah.
The biggest drive for the transition to regen agri is quality, and the current system doesn't allow for doesn't give a much better price for a better quality. We as Grounded are not business to consumer people, so to speak, but there's amazing brands that want to play a big part in changing the food system. And over the whole, so from kombucha brand to tea brands to coffee brands, and they're doing amazing work, spreading word. But they hit so many barriers for them to source. You know, coffee company is one thing, but a tea company, any tea brands, maybe they have 50 to 100 ingredients in their portfolio. So how do they source it? And we initially set up Grounded Ingredients to provide a platform for some of the suppliers and processing companies in South Africa that we were inspired by. We've came across so many also in our pipeline work, not all of them, you know, we work together with, but we were super inspired about the impact, the agricultural progress that they make, from a super innovative rooibos farmer to innovative beekeeping farmer, which try to get organic, which is almost impossible for beekeeping for many multiple reasons. But we wanted to provide them a platform, and that was the start of Grounded Ingredients. But now it's actually that's more of a showroom. But what the result has been is that, especially from the US and from some EU brands, we are now talking to take over part of their sourcing. So we become
they more outsource the sourcing to you, basically, like for this part of our portfolio of ingredients that I need to buy, which is not just this type of tea, but it's also all the other ingredients, because I'm making these funny mixes and infusions, etc. Like, please source it for us with the high quality standards and all the agriculture practices and the good stories, because obviously these brands need stories. But it's not that they can do 50 tea ingredients throughout Southern Africa or East Africa. That's impossible for, it's possible for the Unilevers of this world, but not for these smaller, very mission focused. It's not that they have people just doing that. That's not relevant for them. So they end up sourcing from the commodity side of things, which is a shame, because that's not why they started. So they need to, they basically outsource. So they basically tell you, okay, this part of the portfolio, please go and find it. And you say, okay, let's get going.
Yeah, that's it. And then we try to bundle it. Obviously, we pick our customers at this stage to see, okay, where's the overlap in portfolio, so that one or two sourcing managers, you know, can check it. We also started providing some of our regen agri team capacity to these suppliers by these buyers paying a small premium on it. That goes to our regen agri team. We've also have a, that's another thing, we set up our own regen agri finance, transition finance facility to do more research and more support to these type of suppliers. Also subsidize that a bit, where we raise some money from other family offices to subsidize that. But indeed, they say, okay, what this is our sourcing list. We want to be traceable. 2 out of 50 products are now traceable. This not, and then we say, okay, we know that these products we have in our portfolio, we know good suppliers, or for these products, we think we can find good suppliers. And then we take on a bit of a more traditional role, and we say we buy it, we store it, we bundle it, we ship it, and we keep it ready for you when you need it. But we try to combine it with full transparency and saying, this is what we've bought from the farmers, this is our cost, this is our markup fee, this is our fee for the region agri facility. And we've been inspired by some of the businesses to come up with a name, but they say, you know, if you source enough, you go directly to your customer. But we believe that we can add a lot of value. So there's obviously conflict between sometimes a wholesale company and, you would say, between some of our operating companies. But what we see is that our wholesale company is often much better in supplying these companies, and cheaper and more affordable, because they bundle the ingredients, bring it all together. So then it's for our operating companies more interesting to sell via that route. But we also say to the customers, one day, if you want to buy so much of black pepper and you can get your whole container, go straight. So that's a bit of where we work on. And I think these brands have if you own such a brand, you need to spend 80% of your time on telling the story, going out to the public. You know, that's time that we don't. That's something we don't do because
you
we
tried
don't
that.
Have
remember, you were flirting with that years ago. I remember. Yeah, you were flirting with that, but decided that's not your role. Yeah.
No, it's amazing. I think I see amazing work here in the Netherlands for livestock farmers that have their bundle and have their own milk fresh to the market. But with these longer chains that we are involved in, and the wide range of products, and because I'm not an Instagram person, maybe. So,
that's another role in the value chain. Somebody else needs to do that, and is good at that.
Everybody has a role to play. And, you know, even if we would have a successful own brand, there's so much volume. You know, it's maybe 0.1% of the volume. But if there's hundreds of brands, you know, using our ingredients and using, well, not our ingredients, the ingredients of, you know, some of the top suppliers, and we do have the skills to assess them. We do have the skills to support these suppliers. We do have the skills to test the produce. We do have the skills to support them on certification, to support them in the transition. Yeah, let us try to focus on that. And it's also an interesting pipeline for our OPCO model.
If you can connect to markets, I mean, everything changes. Markets, good prices, okay payment schemes, plus transition, a bit of transition finance support. And I mean, but yeah, good offtake agreements, good markets, focus on quality and of course margin back to the farmers and to the land changes the game. Like there's no question on that.
Yeah, no, and last release, we were raising about $300,000 to $400,000 for this for grounded ingredients. It started off more as a platform, but now the good thing is it's more demand driven. So we take up a bit of funding, as soon as we need more working capital and more clients come in. So there's immediate offtake. So that de-risks that whole business a lot. And make sure that the portfolio creation is much more demand driven. It's nice that sometimes, you know, the optimist beats the perfectionist. You know, we've just started this and we thought, let's put them on the website, and people started to buy samples and I think most of the sales via the website were samples, and then people say, yeah, but we actually need this and this, and then we became more of that wholesale company but more demand driven. And I think that that's all been in a time frame of about 6 months that you were running, that you go into this, and that is almost all 80% of our time and effort that go to meet the demand for some of these clients. And that's a super model, a luxury to have. And again,
which is a great problem to have, yeah.
Yeah, that's these companies, they value, you know, the origin. They value if there's differences and if there's a better quality. They don't mind if there's a different taste, if there's a different vintage for the tea, if there's, they spread
the winification
word
again. Yeah.
The winification. And It's a relief to work with these people that really dive into the details and try to understand and come to visit. And yeah, if you ask me, how do you keep up? Yeah, it's also the energy of these people to make a change and to spread the word and to tell the story and to provide people with the best tea or the best products. And if they then come to work with you on their ingredients, yeah, that gives so much energy. So that's, it started a bit of an in-house trial, the small scale with a couple of team members that came up with it. And now it's growing like that. So that's just super, super to see. And then you see that the whole industry is changing, because I think if we would have done something similar 6-7 years ago, it wouldn't have taken off this way. The brands would not have asked for this. And some research, if you see that the whole top segment is that growth is taken up by these type of front runners, you see that the world is changing and that the new generations, they want a different product. And if we can get great ingredients with full transparency and support these producers with a constant, you know, continuous improvement on Region Agri, because the nice thing about Region Agri, you never finish. So you can always
do it. Theoretically means the quality is never done as well. Like the vinification will continue into, you're never done reaching for the top. I want to thank you so much, Gijs, for this update. It's not the last time we're talking. You will be back and with other people of the team as well. There's so much to unpack here, as this model has been and the work at Grounded has been, I wouldn't say shifting, but like morphing into different forms and shapes. Every time we talk, you made so many steps forward and a few steps backwards to learn. So thank you so much for your time and good luck. And we'll check in soon.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks for having us again, of having me in this case again, Koen. But I would love to come back in maybe a year's time to tell more about how we're doing and keep all of your listeners informed about the progress and the next hurdles and loops that we jump through.
Thank you so much for listening all the way to the end. For the show notes and links we discussed in this episode, check out our website, investinginregenerativeagriculture.com/posts. If you like this episode, why not share it with a friend or give us a rating on Apple Podcasts? That really helps. Thanks again and see you next time.